Hey guys, welcome back to Returnal Podcast. I'm Tyler, of course, your host, and just want to say thank you for joining this episode. Hey, today we're going to interview Emmett Kilduff, co-founder of the Fortea Group. Emmett's a monster. He's been in the e-commerce space forever. He has been around as the market has arced up and as it's kind of arced back down. And I thought this conversation was incredibly insightful because, guys, deals are still happening. Brands are getting acquired. Valuations are still strong for certain kinds of brands. But the things that we need to be focused on right now are maybe not exactly the same as they were a couple years ago. I think you're going to enjoy this conversation with Emmett. I think you're going to find his perspective and mindset kind of thought process refreshing. The habit hack that he gives at the end is, I thought, one of the better ones I've heard in a while. So enjoy this interview with Emmett. And by the way, just as a reminder, hey, these episodes, they're brought to you by Seller Accountant. If your brand is ready to dump the bookkeeping headache, if you're looking to elevate your leadership so that you can scale and, heck, maybe even capture some of the enterprise value that Emmett and I talk about in this interview, please reach out to us. We'd love to step onto your team and become a partner with you as you continue to grow and scale, hopefully towards that exit one day. Without further ado, here's Emmett. It's time to maximize profitability and cash flow. It's time to learn habits and hacks from the best e-com CEOs. It's time for Return on Podcast with me, Tyler Jeffcoat. All right, welcome to today's episode. And guys, today I'm really excited to interview my friend Emmett Kilduff of the Fortea Group. Emmett, how you doing today, man?
Doing great, Tyler. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Well, I'm grateful to have you here. I feel like this is a really timely moment as we kind of launch into 2024 to kind of take another look at the market and exits and valuations and all the stuff that was probably really sexy to talk about 2.5 years ago and has been a little more challenging. Before we dive into that, because I really want to get into the weeds of some of those topics, can you give me just the quick arc of your story? How did you go from I think you're in the banking world maybe to being an actual entrepreneur and building your own, you're the co-founder of the Fortea Group. Give me your journey real quick.
It started out, I did a master's in e-commerce back in 1999, 24 years ago now.
I can't believe that was even a thing, by the way. 1999 is a master's in e-com. Wow.
And it was more of a dot-com boom at the time, many of your listeners will remember, but e-commerce was starting, and I was fascinated with the whole dot-com area, and so I joined the world of investment banking. I joined the firm that was doing the most tech IPOs, you know, the Amazon, literally Amazon IPOs, Google IPOs back in the day. And so that's where I started to learn the whole world of M&A, corporate finance, investment banking, which is obviously very relevant for this conversation. But I was more entrepreneurial than maybe being a small cog in a big wheel or a number of 10,000 or 100,000 employees. And so I left Morgan Stanley, the American investment bank, in 2012 to start up a data company called Eagle Alpha. And that's relevant for this conversation because a hedge fund in New Jersey invested in the data company, and the guy that led the investment happened to be best friends with Carlos Cashman, the founder of Thrasio, and frankly, the founder of the whole e-commerce aggregation space. And so I got to speak to Carlos about 4 years ago now at this stage and became fascinated with the whole role of opportunity with e-commerce and so forth. And so that was the catalyst for me to think, right, what can I do in this space? I'm not an operator. I don't know how to operate brands. I'm just the boring banker, but I do know banking. And so I decided to go sort of full circle back to my start of my career and set up an investment bank focused on e-commerce. But we're not a listing website. We're not a broker. We're trying to bring like Wall Street to small e-commerce comp folks and help them ultimately get the best, to prepare for and get the best deal.
So I want to dig, you have so many things you said there that I want to dig into, but just a kind of a vibe mood check here. So, you know, my conversations with the guys like Carlos or Sebastian at Heyday or some of these other really smart guys that started these companies, you know, the feel, the vibe, Emmett, was a lot different 2.5 years ago than it is right now. For a lot of obvious reasons. I'm just curious, like, what, from your perspective, where are you seeing the acquisition of e-commerce brand market kind of heading? So that's maybe kind of to where we are now. And then kind of where do you see it trailing into the future?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. I guess like the concept of roll-ups has been around for decades. There's a company in Canada called Constellation that's been literally rolling up software business for decades, and very successfully. So Thrasio was emulating that concept of being a roll-up. Very difficult when you end up buying 100 plus brands at the top of the market. Very difficult for anyone globally to sort of manage their way through that, and unfortunately, that's come to a head. Starting an aggregator today is different. If you start fresh today, it's a great time to be a buyer. If you have a super world-class operational team, there's absolutely a great opportunity, whether you're an FBA-led aggregator or a DTC-led aggregator. So, look, the number one reason why businesses succeed is timing. There's a great TED talk by Bill Gross, one of my favorite TED talks on the West Coast. He analyzed 100 startups that fail, 100 startups that succeeded. Timing's the number one thing. It's not funding, it's not business model, it's not, team, etc. It's timing. And unfortunately, Thrasio, it looked like they got the timing perfect, but ultimately, with COVID, etc., the timing in retrospect wasn't great. But you can't. It's very hard to time timing.
Sure.
So some of the other early folks like Thrasio are in severe difficulty. Some going bankrupt. Some looking for a way out of their financial difficulties. But it's not all bad news, and it really frustrates me that the press only talk about the bad news. There are aggregators doing very well. There's an investment bank on Wall Street selling one, doing 400 million revenue, 40 million EBITDA, right? Really successful. There's lots of some aggregator profitable at the corporate EBITDA level. We're under term sheet to sell an Amazon house of brands doing $30 million to an aggregator that's cash rich and got a strong balance sheet. Personally, I like the aggregators that are defined by a niche, either by geography or category, instead of trying to be all things to all people. And I think that's played out there. They seem to be the more successful ones. So there's a lot going on. Some of the big guys are going to fail. There's lots of mergers of folks to seek revenue and cost synergies to survive. There are some doing well, and there are some backs against the wall, and their creditors are trying to find new homes and corporate actions. So it's going to be a bit of a roller coaster ride for the next 6 months, 6 to 9 months maybe for some of these folks. But ultimately, I think the really good ones will survive. And hopefully next year's a better chapter for the world economy, the e-commerce sector, and for the aggregators and individual e-commerce brands. I don't think it can get that much worse than sort of since the correction in sort of at Q2 last year.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a the reason this is interesting, even for more of a, almost call us rank and file million to $10 million brand owners, is that the aggregators have had such a disproportionate impact on valuations in the market that it really does behoove us. I mean, it's important for us that are maybe we're really granularly focused on our five products or on our two marketplaces or Shopify site or whatever. But I think it's incredibly important for us to be dialed in to what's happening in these capital markets and how these boards of directors react to restructuring some of that capital infusion and debt that's kind of stuck on these balance sheets. And yeah, buddy, I think that's really, really interesting. So this may be a nice segue into kind of the valuation discussion. So obviously valuations are not quite what they were a few years ago, but can you give us some nuggets on what is happening in the world of valuing an e-commerce brand, and maybe even drop a couple of nuggets of things that would be more important drivers now than they were a couple of years ago?
It's probably the most common question I get asked. Rather than giving you my view on this given day, we decided to productize our house view formally every quarter into a 50-page deck and a webinar with guest speakers to talk about all this, because it's really important that first of all we educate brand owners into what goes into the valuation mix, and then keep them on top of trends, as you're alluding to. There's certain things, Tyler, that are in your control and certain things that are outside of your control, right? So, the global economy, you and I cannot control that, or your listeners cannot control that, but it absolutely affects everything from interest rates to inflation and that
That's right.
affects the lending rates and the confidence of acquirers, etc. And that, that impacts valuation multiples and supply and demand. The fact that there's not as many aggregators looking to acquire is a supply demand function. Two years ago, when we put out deals, we were able to get LOIs, letters of intent, within 5 days. It was, in 20 plus years of corporate finance, I'd never seen that. You can't do it today. You need to be, the frenzy is not there. Valuations were sort of at their highest, I think, in Q4 2021. And if we look at it in two different buckets, so these sort of FBA-led brands and DTC-led brands, FBA-led brands were getting up to sort of 7x. I think that's the highest number I've heard of from everyone I speak to, and that's quite a wide network. On the DTC side, valuations were getting up into the high teens. DTC valuations are higher because of a number of reasons, mainly because they own their customer details. That's important to highlight to your listeners. What we've done over the last few quarters is give our view each quarter. And at the moment, for FBA-led brands, Tyler, the range for typical exits is 2.5 to 4 times seller discretionary earnings. And for DTC-led brands, for typical brands, it's 4x to 12x. Now, there's exceptions on the downside and the upside. On the downside, distressed brands, you go lower than 2.5 for FBA and lower than 4 for DTC. We don't get involved in distressed brands. It's very, very difficult to make a market. So we're looking to sell, good quality growth brands. There's exceptions to the downside, but there's also exceptions to the upside. If you've got an FBA brand that's got really high revenue growth, net margins above 20%, a repeat purchase rate of, in the tens or high tens, awesome. That stands out. And you're in a great category that buyers want today, like pets or beauty or, baby. On the DTC side, if you're 100% recurring revenue or subscription revenue, you can absolutely be looking for more than 12x. That's a game changer versus ad hoc or one-off revenue, as you know, with your background. I personally think we're putting out our Q4 numbers in mid-January. I don't think there'll be that much change. There's not that much change in the markets today. Q3 versus Q4. There's been another war, unfortunately, which is terrible. I think we're getting better clarity that maybe interest rates will come down, which is positive. Let's see what Q4 happens from a consumer spending perspective. That's what it's all about now in the next, with Thanksgiving and Black Friday and Christmas. A key period which will drive valuations up. The final thing I'd say, I don't think we're going to get I don't think valuations will get any lower in Q1 or Q2. I think there's upside opportunity. It won't be massive, but it should be a small uptick. I can't see valuations going down.
Yeah, I love it. You mentioned a couple of things there, Emma. Just want to punctuate these for guys that are listening to this or watching this on YouTube. I think what I heard you say, and this has been true forever, but there's been a little bit of a regression back to common sense that, of course, these things are true. The more of the customer experience that I own, the higher the valuation. In other words, if I'm direct to consumer where I have the email address and it's easier to repurpose and it's easier for me to get in front of my customer again because they're mine, they're my customer, I'm going to be able to command a higher value. Doesn't mean that there's not a place for marketplace sales. I mean, a huge chunk of what Seller Accountant does is Amazon FBA sales. But just understand that the economics of selling those assets are different. The second thing you mentioned is really the obvious one is that higher margin. And in particular, like true contribution margin, we call it PAG. It's just post advertising. I want to get Amazon fees, COGS, and those ad dollars where I can truly understand. And then everyone's got a small overhead load, but being able to tell a story of responsible use of your overhead dollars. And then the third thing I heard you say, obviously having higher margins, surprise, you get better valuations. But I think that automatic repurchase intense kind of subscription-ish model kinds of products are really favored in any market, but in particular right now where you're looking for more predictability and cash flow. What did I miss there in terms of other things that you think are really the key levers and drivers of valuation right now?
Well, I think that's a good start. I think I think the one thing entrepreneurs do, which really frustrates me, or what they lack, well, actually what they don't do, is they don't prepare well enough for their exits. So you take me back to my Morgan Stanley days. The very big corporates in America and around the world, they spend 1 to 2 years preparing their exit. It's really frustrating when an e-commerce entrepreneur, FBA or DTC, comes to me and says, hey, we want to sell, you know, next month or next quarter. That is not thoughtful. That is, you know, fail to prepare, prepare to fail. I'll give you some examples. So we had a business that the acquirer sent someone to the factory in China to do diligence on the manufacturing plant and you know, facility, and got an incredibly low score and killed the deal. And so there's, and then, you know, for the brand owner, that could cost $700 to get that test done. So why wouldn't you sort of tick that off and get rid of a potential red flag for the investment committee to require down the road? So there's lots of red flags that you can, we can identify to help a brand along the journey. But there's also some low hanging fruits that can be done to increase revenue or decrease costs, improve net margin. And there's other things that buyers would expect, which a lot of sellers don't realize. And so I would urge your listeners to start try and plan, you know, as far out as possible for an exit. Yep. You know, do what Elon Musk would do. Do what Zuckerberg would do. They wouldn't rush into it. They'd be very thoughtful about it. And so why shouldn't everyone on this podcast think early? And that would be my biggest piece of advice or takeaway for your guests.
That's really good. I mean, and I'll give you another practical example of that. We had our most common challenge when we try to get an e-commerce native brand through due diligence. Obviously, the part that's coming out of Amazon is pretty easily verifiable data. The cost of goods sold inventory side of it, however, is really challenging. Like that's the part that due diligence can really get stuck in the mud if you don't have good records. And I mean, right towards the end of that feeding frenzy, we had a couple of brands come to us and do exactly what you said. What's the state of affairs? The state of affairs is that we don't have any accounting. Okay. What's the state of affairs for inventory management? Spreadsheet and a prayer. Okay. What do we have? 2,000 SKUs. Okay. Got it. But we're going to go to market. We're going to start our process of putting this packet out to strategics in 6 weeks. And there's a particularly large version of what I just told you, Emmett, where, oh, we just got the perfect deal. The value would have been there. And the ability to properly diligence, to your point, diligence that cost of goods sold accounting, I guess, kind of my world, right? The accounting side of it was impossible to a point where the board rejected the deal. It was a deal that didn't make it to the finish line. And it was terrible timing for that deal to not go to the finish line because a lot of the aggregators started struggling like that next quarter. And so I think your point is well taken. It's one thing to wake up and realize, ooh, I might have been late. I need to be a little bit decisive here to get this going. But if you're not currently in that crisis right now, guys, hear what Emmett's saying. It's like now's the time to slow down for a minute and plan for what your objective is with this asset that you're building. Know your objective now. Other quick story I'll tell that was the flip side of this, where a guy knew what he wanted. And during this feeding frenzy with the aggregators, got that offer and turned it down because he had FOMO. He feared that he could get more. Ultimately, ended up having to take a much smaller deal a year later as the market kind of sobered. And so I feel like that's what I'm learning. As an observer, I've only sold one business about 6 or 7 years ago. So I'm learning a lot more as a CFO than I did as a guy who sold my own company. And what I'm learning is I've got to know what my objective is for this investment. And to your point, don't want to make the mistake of not planning ahead to be ready, because when the timing, again, you and I can't control timing, but when the timing is right, my number is there, I've got to be ready to jump on it and really execute my strategy and get paid versus gambling and waiting to see something more or hoping that I can squeak through due diligence without good records and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with that. And I think like it's really interesting to see the different mentality of FBA-led entrepreneurs versus DTC-led entrepreneurs. FBA-led entrepreneurs are you know, the teams are very small, in some cases one person with lots of VAs. And those people ultimately have to be a jack of all trades. It's really tough, right? You've got to learn about inventory, online marketing, finance, operations. And then you've also got to think about corporate finance or how to sell a business. And most of those companies or brands are so small that they don't have boards of advisors. Whereas a DTC brand has to raise more money because they've got to find their customers, which means they have more of a team or an org chart and investors, VCs, boards. And, it's a different setup. But what it does bring you is advisors that can maybe help you think about or navigate the journey towards fundraising or an exit. The FBA folks don't have that. So it's they're at a little bit of a disadvantage to sort of help think about preparing or having a sounding board of advisors. I mean, I would encourage, if there's a pet entrepreneur on this call who's doing $5 million, I would encourage he or she to try and reach out to an e-com entrepreneur who sold a business for 50 or 100 million, give them share options in your business to help you navigate towards a successful trade. Get mentorship, get advisors early that been there, done that, and made the mistakes and know how to, you know, navigate through the difficult journeys. Because sometimes, and I'll be really frank, sometimes the entrepreneurs I speak to are just, they're too confident. They think they can do everything themselves. But the best laid plans only survive contact with the enemy. If you've never sold a business, how do you know what a best laid plan is? How can you create a plan that's going to be ready for the enemy? I speak to buyers every day. I know what the enemy is looking for, and I can help you have a better battle plan. That's what we're here to do. You don't want to go into your war without experience. Sorry to bring a war anecdote into it. That's not very sensitive, but hopefully you get what I mean.
No, but it's well said, and I think you're right. I think sometimes the mindset of a successful, and Emma and I are talking about wildly successful FBA centric product brands. Sometimes that mindset is very much a hustler mindset. Like, I hated the corporate job. I developed a product. I understood the algorithm. I figured out PPC. I flew to China once or twice and sourced my product. And so it's not that I'm like explicitly arrogant, although some of those guys can be, but I think the mindset just has to shift. What got me to $3 million in revenue with Amazon selling my 20 products isn't going to get me to 10 million in revenue. And what's going to get me to 10 million in revenue probably isn't going to get me to 50 million in revenue. And so I think you dropped some nuggets there, Emmett, that I think are really wise. One is the bottlenecks are always at the top. And so I need to find people who can coach and mentor me so that I can. I mean, guys, I don't care what category you're selling in. Somebody out there has lost millions of dollars in your category, making small tactical mistakes that they could probably, over a beer or a cup of coffee, stop you from making. Somebody, you got to find them. I don't know where they are, but somebody in your category woke up one day and realized, I wish I hadn't done that, because that was a $5 million problem that I created for myself. And so know that that's the case. Now, if that's not your ambition, if you're not looking to create more scale in your company, I think that's also something that some sellers need to have permission for, Emmett, right? Like, I don't want to get bigger. That's fine. But know who you are and be ready to exit at the right moment. And don't try to become a $10 million company if you're not willing to lead an organization, like you said, that has an org chart and stuff like that.
Yeah, and I 100% agree with that. It doesn't suit everyone's skill set to go to 10 or 50 or 100 million. You need to know where your strengths and weaknesses are and be honest with yourself about that and try and plug the gaps or sell at a certain period. I think it's worth talking about, you know, the fact that some of the aggregators are in difficulty. If a brand gets to, say, at least $10 million, the owners earned the right to try and sell to private equity and strategics. Private equity as a bolt-on to a current portfolio asset and a small strategic. It's not just selling to Thrasio and those types of firms, right? So, and people might be worried about reading the press that there's no acquirers left, but that's not true. It takes longer, but frankly, you can get higher multiples. Private equity. And let me start again. Like before aggregators came along, there were two types of institutional buyers: private equity firms and strategics. And you know, aggregators are new. They're in the last 4 years. Some are facing difficulty, but there are plenty of acquirers out there if you get to sort of 10 million. If you're small and below 10 million, you know, it's a smaller pie. It's a smaller pool, including family offices and at the smaller end individuals. We personally, at the Fortier Group, we don't deal with individual buyers. There are others that are better at that. We're dealing with firms that are doing at least 5 million revenue. But if there's a pet business doing $50 million in revenue, one of their growth avenues is to acquire other pet brands, smaller brands, and maybe niches that they haven't entered yet. And so if you've got $5 million, $7 million, $10 million, you could absolutely be an interesting target for another successful pet business. Something to keep in mind.
I love it. I think it's really well said. Well, okay, so I want to, moving towards kind of landing our discussion here, what do you, I want to talk to you about things that are not strictly related to e-commerce. What's a hobby or something fun that you're chewing on here recently that might, I don't know, that might be interesting for us to chat about?
Well, I've done, since I left the world of investment banking, Tyler, I've done a few startups, and it's kept me really busy. And right. I had a health scare 18 months ago. It led me to think about what I could do to manage my well-being better. And I went on to the app stores, and I couldn't find a single app out of 7 million apps for men's well-being, not one. And so I saw a gap in the market, then spent a few months identifying if there was a market in the gap, and convinced myself it was through focus groups and research, etc. And so in 4 weeks' time, I'm launching an app called Pit Stop on the app stores that is dedicated to help men's well-being. And so that's fun. That's my hobby right now. I'm focused on helping men think about physical health, mental health, purpose, trying to balance relationships with work, balance career goals with leisure, you know, all those sorts of stuff that we deal with as busy folks day to day.
Emmett, that's so cool. So by the way, just in case you guys are wondering, Emmett and I are recording this right around Thanksgiving here, kind of getting to the end of 2023. This episode will launch here in a few weeks, Emmett. So we'll make sure, if you can get us some links that we have, you know, in addition, to make sure people can find you at the fortiagroup.com. That any dudes, any bros out there listening to this that are looking to enhance well-being, I think you said Pit Stop, is that right?
Yeah, our whole idea is we want men to try and take a pit stop regularly. Yeah. And just even 10 minutes a day to sort of step back and think about your life and where you're strong, where you're weak, what you'd like to try and address. And the website's called takeapitstop.com, and the app will be ready in just before the holidays in December.
takeapitstop.com. I love it. So final question I want to ask you here, something I ask all of our guests here, Emmett, is, and it may be along the lines of what you just articulated, but is there a habit or a practice or a rhythm that gives you an unusual kind of ROI in your life? Something that you're like, boys and girls, if you could just pick this up and do this regularly, you would see amazing results in your life. Does anything pop into your mind when I ask you that question?
Well, maybe from a more of a work perspective, one of the key changes I did a few months ago was I decided to spend most of my mornings on deep work. Okay. So I start work at 7, and between 7 and 11, I don't talk to anybody, and I try not to look at any emails or messages, and I do 8 Pomodoros. Pomodoro is a technique, a 25-minute technique with a 5-minute break. And the 8 Pomodoros are on 8 of the most important tasks that would move the needle, the 80-20 Pareto principle. And since I've been doing that, it's been wonderful. Yeah, I don't get distracted. There's too much stuff going on in this world right now, right? Just focus. What would move the needle? tomorrow morning, and I pick my topics the evening before, and I try and nail them. And you don't always get them right, but it's that process or system, I think, can move the needle for. So it certainly worked for me, and might be of interest to your listeners.
And you mentioned deep work. Did you read, is it Cal Newport that wrote the book Deep Work? Is that one that's been on your list here?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, so good. Well, guys, I mean, like, so what Emmett just said there, I think, is so powerful. So it is the, if you read studies on how many undistracted minutes of productivity the average knowledge worker in our world gets right now, first of all, you're going to be depressed if you have employees because they are not nearly as productive as you want them to be. And when you really do an audit of your own energy, and I've done this time and time again, you're going to find that what Emmett just said is one of the most important hacks that you can add into your life just to delete the noise, turn off the notifications, and do real work. Love it, man. I think that's such good advice. Hope people will take you up on that. Let me give you a quick opportunity to kind of tell us a little bit more about your specifically your services at Fortea Group. What is the guy feeling like? What is he going through right now, where he's in a spot where he needs to go to your website and book a consult to learn more about what you're doing at the Fortea Group?
Yeah, going back to that whole concept of preparation is key. If there's listeners that are thinking about exiting their business on a 1, 2, or 3 year view, please just give us a call. If you've got more than 5 million revenue, and then we can help either do an audit today to sort of get you on your way with some pieces of advice for the next 12 months, or we can help you plan towards starting a process in January, whatever it might be. But ha happy to explore the right avenue for those folks. But it's yeah, just start planning as soon as you can. And as we've talked about on this call, look for mentors and advisors, whether you work for with the Fortune Group or not. Please, for the sake of giving up some share options in your business, I always think a smaller piece of a bigger pie is the obvious way to go. That's what all the big successful entrepreneurs in the Valley have done, and I have advisory panels on all my businesses, and I love getting mentored and bouncing ideas off all those folks. So I'd encourage mentorship and preparation.
I love it. And Emmett, that requires kind of a growth abundant mindset, I think. I think something that's behind the ability to I think sometimes we, and I can do this also, so I'm not pointing fingers at anyone else, but sometimes we can, trip over a dollar to pick up a nickel, right? Or that kind of. And so I think what I admire about you, and I don't know you very well, but as I've gotten to know you over the last couple of years, I really admire that. There's something to it, guys. If you have an abundant, a prudent but abundant mindset, and you find the quest, you find your quest to be to find the who's. Who is it in my life that's going to give me an unusual ROI? Man, is it worth a point? Is it worth some kind of an option on the business? Probably. If it's the wrong person, then write the option in a way that you can find ways to get out of it. But I think you got to be really careful not to be so inwardly tightly wound and focused that you lose sight of the big picture. So I think that's great advice, Emmett. Thank you. Emmett, thank you so much for joining Return on Podcast. It's been a thrill having you. I'm going to make sure everyone has access to your links when we post the episode here. But I just want to say thank you, brother, for joining me.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure, Tyler. Thank you so much.
All right. And so just to close this episode, guys, thank you for joining Emmett and myself for, hey, listen, you've made it 30 minutes into a podcast on from two recovering bankers talking about valuations and getting ready to sell. Ugh, what are you doing with yourself right now? I'm just kidding. I really hope that this episode generated some value, some food for thought for you. And you can find more resources related to that food for thought at selleraccountant.com. Grateful for the guys there helping us continue to run this podcast. So for myself and for Emmett, we just want to wish you a great day, have a great week, and we'll see you next time. Cheers.